Welcome to everybody, and thank you for coming. This is the fifth night of a course I've been giving in embryology here at Holden Village. If you haven't been here for the first four, that's okay. I think you'll get something out of tonight anyway. Some of the pictures we show might be a little bit foreign to you. But what we've talked about so far is the development of a new human being, creation of God, from fertilization to the implantation in the uterus, the development from implantation through the embryo stage when the baby is constructing all of its organs, its arms and legs, its hands and its feet, through the fetal period as the baby grows in size and in capabilities to live outside of the body. And now we're up to the last night, which the only natural close to this is the birth of a baby. I guess I would say that to me, having the privilege of taking part in the birth of a baby many times, I would say that it doesn't get old. When the phone rings and I have to go in at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd be lying if I said whoopee. But once I got there, it's worth being there. And we can talk a lot about, I hope we'll have time at the end for questions tonight, more than other nights. And we can talk a little bit more about specifics of labor and delivery. But here we have now a pregnancy that has made it to 38 weeks since the time of fertilization, 266 days. Your doctor will be talking in terms of 40 weeks because he's counting from your last menstrual period, because that's a lot more easily known than is the date of fertilization. And 280 days on average will be about the time that labor begins. What causes labor? Well, I think that whatever impressiveness we might show as being physicians, I think you can forget when we do not know what causes labor. After all the years that people have been delivering babies, we don't have the foggiest idea about what actually is the biochemical event that causes labor. Thankfully, it seems to be tied into the maturity of the baby to some extent, though not always, and that not always is something we wish we could prevent, because prematurity is a major cause of death for babies around the time of birth. Okay. So tonight, let's talk a little bit about the onset of labor. There's some things that we do know about it. It's not related strictly to hormones. It's not related to estrogen or progesterone, though some changes in that occur at the time of labor. It probably has something to do with the maturity of the baby's adrenal glands, but that's how it works in sheep. We do know that. But it isn't quite the full explanation in people. At any rate, what happens at labor is a very exciting physiologic process, which is not always perfectly pleasant, but is always fulfilling. We're going to talk about labor in three stages. The first stage we're going to be talking about in terms of cervical dilatation. The cervix is the outlet of the uterus, okay? And it, in normal condition, is closed. And so I talk about from zero dilatation to complete dilatation, which means big enough to get a baby's head through, is the first stage of labor. Well, how does that happen? Well, one of the things that people in childbirth classes learn about is that there's absolutely nothing that you can do to help make that cervix open up more. A woman has no voluntary control over it at all, and a matter of fact, the best thing that one can do is try to store up energy for the later parts of labor when you can do something about it. In the first stage of labor, contractions of the uterine muscle, which, like I said, you have very little to no control over, cause a pulling and stretching of the muscle fibers in the lower part of the uterus, and is eventually sort of using the baby's head as a wedge, pulls the cervix which is mostly connective tissue, around the top of the baby's head until it is large enough opening, somewhere around like this, to allow the baby's head to come through. So during labor, during the first stage of labor, you go from a cervix that's closed to a cervix that is 10 centimeters or a little bit more in diameter. The nurses or physicians check that to see how your progress is going in labor, because we know what should be normal progress. If this is a graph, number of hours versus centimeters of dilatation from 1 to 10, we can expect that at the beginning, progress is real slow. This again is always on the average. Everybody can be different. But for a prima gravida, for a first pregnancy, this latent stage of labor, we call it, from zero dilatation to about 3 centimeters, can take about 8 hours. We don't even consider it abnormal until we're out around 20 hours, okay? The important thing of it is usually this is not terribly uncomfortable. If it is terribly uncomfortable, what your doctor should do is get you rest, because there's a lot of time to come. However, when magically we hit about 3 centimeters, something changes in there, and once again, we don't understand what it is, but something happens that with the same intensity of the contractions, the same pressure inside the uterus, same size baby, that hasn't changed any, the cervix starts to dilate more rapidly, a very rapid slope, so that you can expect at least 1.5 centimeters an hour progress during this active phase of the first stage of labor. It slows down again for most people somewhere around 8 to 8.5 centimeters or so, but you're making it then. By the time complete dilatation has occurred and the outlet from the uterus is big enough to let the baby through, then finally, after what could be many hours for the woman, she can do something to actually help, and that's use voluntary muscles to push the baby out. And that does require muscular effort on the part of the woman, as well as using the help of the uterine contractions. So hopefully you've stored up some energy from the beginning until the time of cervical dilatation. And we can thank God a bit for all the prenatal classes that are around, because there's a lot more patients who are ready to push when the time comes than used to be. Okay, so when we get ready to do the voluntary pushing, when the cervix is completely dilated, we have reached the second stage of labor. In the second stage of labor, there's no more cervix to get rid of. The baby's head starts to descend into the pelvis, into the vagina, and hopefully we'll make steady progress from there until birth. Like I said, we can get into details about labor and delivery afterwards if there are questions. But that may take, it takes on the average about 2 hours for a first-time mother. 2 more hours after complete dilatation to push the baby out. The average time for a second-time mother is about 20 minutes. That's average, so there are a lot of people that are faster than that. Then the third stage of labor is also fascinating. After the baby is delivered, then we have to get rid of the placenta. But remember how I mentioned the other night that by the end of the pregnancy, the blood vessels to the uterus are huge. They are as big around as my thumbs. And you can imagine how much blood that would pour out if it was just going to merrily roll along, okay? And there's no amount of blood clotting that you could do that would ever stop a stream that was as big around as my thumb. So it's not dependent on blood clotting, it's dependent on the uterine contractions. Once again, God's design of the uterus and this whole system is just a miracle. The muscle fibers are interlaced and crisscrossed and one way or another all wrapped around the blood vessels so that when the muscles contract, it kinks off the blood vessels. Beautiful design. So that when the uterus changes from being up underneath the ribs here somewhere in the neighborhood of the size of a basketball to contracting down to the size of, oh, maybe like a Nerf football size, there's an awful lot of constriction of those blood vessels, and that's what stops bleeding. When that doesn't happen, that's what causes bleeding. But thankfully, in most cases, everything is normal and that constriction develops. As the uterus comes down and the muscles contract, you can think of the placenta being spread over a wide area of the interior of the uterus. And now all of a sudden, that area that the placenta is spread over contracts, and the placenta naturally tends to shear off because where it was attached is now pulling together. And so the placenta will shear off and spontaneously deliver. And the average time is about 5 minutes after delivery of the baby. We don't consider it abnormal until we get out around 20 minutes, but thankfully it's not too long a time. Okay, well, with those preliminary words, we got a couple slides to look at, and then we're going to talk a little bit about what's happening with the baby after it's delivered. Well, once again, just want to remind you of what our text for this whole series is, the Gospel of St. John, the first chapter. Get a chance to read that. These are the primary movements of the baby as it's entering into the pelvis and making its way down. As you can see, the mother's legs are up, but she's sort of divided the long way right down the middle with the spine along the back. The rectum is here, the vagina here, and the pubic bone up in front. The cervix is closed here. The baby is outside of the pelvis. There's the pubic bone. And there's the sacrum. So the true pelvis is right there. The baby is outside of it in this first picture. Now, you can see how the thickness of this cervix goes away initially. That's called effacement. And then we start to have pulling away of the cervix so that dilatation occurs and the baby's head is descending into the pelvis at the same time. Again, there's the pubic bone, and there's the sacrum back here, so you can see the baby's head has made a lot of progress. Now, as the baby's coming down, it wants to present the narrowest diameter that it possibly can to get out of there, okay? And the narrowest diameter for the baby's head is the biparietal diameter from here to here. So the best way for the baby to present that is to put its chin down right on its chest and make this the presenting part. If babies are facing out with their head extended, that can cause problems. If their head isn't completely flexed, that can cause some problems. Though it's usually a temporary one. It starts to enter into the pelvis and usually turns its head sideways in relation to mother and enters the pelvis initially sideways. And then, as you can see, the head starts to rotate so that the face turns straight down by the time that the baby has reached the floor of the pelvis. This happens about 90% of cases. In about 10% of cases, the baby will decide to turn straight face up toward the ceiling. And that can cause sometimes a little prolongation of labor and is kind of famous for causing back pain during labor. Okay, so when the baby's head hits the perineal floor, hits the floor of the pelvis here, it can't go any longer in the direct line that the uterus and the abdominal wall is pushing it, obviously. The tailbone is there and other things that you just as soon have remain intact. So the baby then starts to extend its head and lifts its chin from off of its chest like this and brings its neck underneath this pubic bone and out into the world. By extension, simply by the motion of extension, delivers the baby's head. Now, when it gets out, the shoulders are about in the same place that the head was a few moments ago. And so the first thing the baby does after looking at the doctor's feet is turn toward one of the thighs, the left or the right thigh, and look at mother's thigh, okay? You can see here the baby is looking right at us. And at this point, the anterior shoulder, which is this baby's right shoulder, has made it out. And then with a little gentle elevation on the baby's head, the posterior shoulder is delivered. And after the shoulders are out, we're home free. I've never had a baby stick after that, okay? Now, there you can see how the uterus has had a wide surface area here with the placenta extended over a long surface area. And now it's all bunched up and the placenta has sheared off and a bunch of blood clot has formed behind it, of course. And the placenta is forced out and with maybe a little bit of traction on the umbilical cord is delivered. Okay. I'm not going to get into obstetric practices unless people are really interested in it afterwards. And this is the product of the labors. That's about 3 minutes after birth. This baby's pretty pink. Sometimes they're not quite this pink. Also, it's Kodachrome film, which makes them look pinker. Okay. Now, let's talk just a little bit about the exciting changes that are happening in the baby at this time. Let's look specifically at the heart, lungs, and the circulation, because they make the biggest change. Just as a review, as adults, most of you probably know this, the blood has to be shifted through the lungs to obtain all the oxygen. And one side of the heart, the right side of the heart, is entirely committed to the purposes of pushing blood through the lungs so that it gets oxygenated. Then when the blood comes back oxygenated from the lungs, it comes to the left side of the heart and then is pushed from the left side of the heart into the entire system where the rest of the body can utilize that oxygen. Okay. Now the situation is entirely different in a baby before it's born because the lungs don't have any oxygen to give. And there's no reason to push all that blood through the lungs. The lungs don't need that much blood to develop. So we have to develop some shunts to not waste all that time and effort on the part of the right heart to push blood through the lungs. So let's look at it starting from, well, a good place to start is from the aorta, okay? This is the large artery that comes out of the heart, which eventually feeds all the blood vessels in the body. And that's where you want oxygenated blood to be. Okay. Now, in the fetus, before birth, okay, there are two arteries that come off of the first branches of the aorta, the so-called iliac arteries, and come forward and out through the belly button and down the umbilical cord to the placenta. Okay. Those are the umbilical arteries. Now, in the placenta, it gets oxygenated. You can see that this is not as bright red as this, okay? So that most of the oxygen the baby's going to get, and it's nowhere near as much as it will get when it gets lungs, but all the oxygen it's going to get is coming from the placenta and returns via this umbilical vein. Now, we don't have umbilical veins in our body anymore at this stage, but this is a pretty good-sized blood vessel in a fetus. It's got to carry all that blood back from the placenta. And it crosses through right underneath the liver, and about half of the blood actually goes into the liver. I'm sorry, about 20% of the blood actually goes through the liver, and about 80% of it gets shunted off into the large vein that returns to the heart, the inferior vena cava, okay? This is carrying all the blood back from the baby's legs and from everything below the waist comes into the inferior vena cava. And it gets mixed up. You can see this is very deoxygenated blood, the blue blood, gets mixed with the bright red blood and we get sort of an intermediate stage here that's partly mixed up, okay? Mixture of unoxygenated and oxygenated blood. Now comes the tricky part. This right side of the heart is in charge of pushing blood to the lungs, but we don't want all that blood to go to the lungs. So God designed it so that there forms, just like a hose, a fairly vigorous current right in through this inferior vena cava, and it aims at this little window between the two sides of the heart. It has a flap on it, a flap valve, if you will, and it pushes that flap out of the way and the blood shoots across to the left side of the heart and from there is sent into the ventricle and out through the aorta and is sent to the rest of the body. So a good portion of the blood is just bypassing the right heart completely. Okay? Now, the stuff that gets into the right heart, which is a fair amount, from just, you can see that not everything is going to hit that little hole exactly right, so it's going to splash around a little bit. And we're going to get blood into the right side of the heart. That is pushed out into the pulmonary artery, into the right and left lungs. But once again, God said, still too much waste on these lungs that all they have to do is grow. We're just building all those huge arteries so that you can use the lungs after you're born. So there's another shunt, this thing called the ductus arteriosus, which is a fairly large opening in fetal life so that the blood has a preference from passing from the right side of the heart between the pulmonary arteries that are going to the lungs right into the aorta again. So by far, most of the blood is going to go into the aorta and a little bit goes into the pulmonary arteries. Now, you can see how that system is great for fetal life, but it's horrible when you get oxygen in the lungs and no placenta there anymore, right? You certainly wouldn't want to have all that blood bypassing the lungs and not getting any oxygen. So, from the moment of birth, some fascinating things happen. The first thing that happens at birth, everybody talks about the baby screaming, etc., maybe, but the most important thing is it gets air in its lungs. With the air in its lungs, because of the way the blood vessels are interlaced amongst the air sacs in the lungs, that decreases the amount of resistance there is in that pulmonary artery system. There is now much easier blood flow into the lungs than there was before birth. The other thing that happens is that what blood gets there gets an awful lot of oxygen compared to what the baby was getting from mom. An awful lot of oxygen. So that the baby's level of oxygen in its blood immediately goes up. Two things happen. Well, three things happen. First of all, the umbilical cord is cut. And now there's no place for this blood to go anyway. And there's all immediately no blood return through this umbilical vein that used to be there. And it remains as a little piece of connective tissue that if any of you ever had your gallbladder out, the surgeon had to go by in order to get your gallbladder out. It's called the ligamentum teres now, which means a round ligament of the liver. And what it used to be was the umbilical vein. But you can still find it in people. Okay. Now, at the time of that first breath, the pressure in the heart is transferred so that all of a sudden there's more pressure on the left side, the side that leads to the aorta, than the right side. And as a result, that little flap here flaps shut. All of a sudden, there's more pressure here than there is here, so the little valve flaps shut. And all of a sudden, all this blood decides to stay in the right side. The other thing that happens is that big artery we saw here, the ductus arteriosus, when it starts to see an increase in the amount of oxygen in the blood, it was designed biochemically so that when the oxygen tension goes up, it muscularly constricts and closes right off that area right there and becomes a ligament again, the ligamentum arteriosum. And these things happen within moments of birth so that the baby can now send 100% of its cardiac output into the lungs to get oxygenated. And it's, once again, the miracle continues even immediately after birth. So that while all this is happening, you are getting the first cuddle of the baby. Everybody is pretty happy. It's a pretty magic moment. But the miracle goes on even while you're distracted with saying, I think he looks like you. No, I think he looks like you. Okay. Well, we're going to leave some time at the end here. So I'd like to turn off the lights and let you look at a little bit of a summary that I have of what we've been doing for the past 5 days. Thank you, Chris. Thank you. you so much for your attention over this time. There's an awful lot of biomedical issues that we can get into in talking about embryology, labor, and delivery. And I'd be willing to talk about any of them that we're interested in, such as in vitro fertilization, the test tube baby thing, surrogate mothers, artificial insemination, labor and delivery practices, etc. So anybody who has interests or questions about what we've been talking about, let them fly. No, we don't use a birthing chair. We use a birthing bed, an Adele bed, it's called. I'm personally not a very big fan of birthing chairs. They decrease your flexibility considerably. The birthing bed, however, gives you sort of the best of both worlds. You can have a sitting up labor and delivery, or you can have an emergency forceps delivery if you need to. So that's what we use. Other questions? Well, like I said, I was willing to talk about them. I don't know if I have answers. We don't have that program in Rochester by any means, and Rochester being the community it is, it's pretty doubtful we ever will. But in large metropolitan areas, it's becoming a fairly big business. I think that many of you probably read about the baby who was born in a surrogate mother sort of contract, and then the baby had microcephaly and mental retardation, and the baby ended up in no man's land, no woman's land either, as neither the payees nor the bearees wanted to take the baby. And I think that sort of opens up a large can of worms, if you will, when we start treating fetuses and embryos and pregnancies as property that can be bought and sold, you're going to end up having the usual sort of human contractual problems that you have with every other piece of property. I guess if you're going to get into it, you're going to have an awfully good lawyer. But my advice would be don't get into it. Well, we've had a very useful fertility drug for quite a few years that has also been the one blamed for multiple births, fives and sixes and bad things like that. Don't get me wrong, five babies are fine if they survive, but they have very little chance of surviving on taken as a group. As a matter of fact, when you end up with triplets, you're talking about in the neighborhood of 40% perinatal mortality. So that's pretty significant. So you want to avoid those kind of multiple births. The real key, Clomid, just like all medications and all tools in medicine, it's not the medicine that's the problem, it's the brains behind it. And Clomid is very useful in people who are not ovulating, who need to be stimulated to ovulate, and using the lowest dose possible until you obtain the result that you want, and then not increasing the dose. The problem is that people came in complaining of not having children, and there was no analysis made as to why. There was no real assessment about whether or not they truly were beyond what statistically would be appropriate to consider infertility. And Clomid being like penicillin, it's a magic drug for infertility. You just hand it out. If one doesn't work, five will be better. Well, that's a good way to get five babies too. So yes, Clomid, I think, in used properly, has got a very small chance of getting more than twins. Very small chance. Other fertility medications. Remember how we talked about the FSH and LH stimulating the ovary? Well, that's usually what fertility drugs do. You try to stimulate the ovary. Clomid fools your own pituitary gland into thinking that there's not enough estrogen around, that it ought to put out more of that FSH business, and it does. Of course, you can give lots of FSH and LH too, the real thing. And you get that from menopausal women. Menopausal women whose ovaries are not making estrogen, their pituitary gland reads that as being too low and puts out all kinds of FSH and LH, and so there's a large source of that available. And the brand name for that medication is Perganol, and it's exceedingly risky that you'll get multiple bursts with that. So that nobody essentially uses it without daily monitoring with ultrasound to see how many follicles are growing in the ovary before you let them get pregnant. So the third fertility drug is one that's called gonadotropin-releasing hormone, GnRH, and that starts even higher on that scale we looked at the very beginning. It starts in the lower portion of the brain. It's the stuff that sends the messages to the pituitary gland. And that's available in California at San Diego, and there's been some very nice results with that, with less hyperstimulation. So that might be something on the horizon. Okay. Those ultrasound pictures, the second one that you saw at 8 weeks, you should be able to tell if you have twins or not by then. And it's very obvious you have two sacs and two babies. And of course, any time from that time forward, it should be able to be picked up on ultrasound. Yes?
This might have been a discussion at one time, I missed, I don't know. I was interested in knowing about when the fetus can be aware of it not being accepted.
The question is regarding what the fetus can feel and when it can feel emotional impacts of situations surrounding the pregnancy, such as being unwanted. I don't believe that data is available. I can tell you that the baby has ears and is capable of picking up vibratory and therefore hearing scents probably somewhere around the 18th to 20th week after fertilization. Pretty early in the pregnancy. Now the effect of that is certainly questionable. Many people describe it as being a very profound effect on the baby, and yet I'm sure everyone that has adopted a baby knows that that baby is probably coming from an unwanted pregnancy, if you will, and I don't think that we have a very high incidence of those children being emotionally disturbed or poor bonding with their new parents. So that there's information that the baby certainly obtains stimuli from outside the uterus. It can definitely hear. It can definitely be affected by the mother's emotional state in terms of major changes in blood pressure, etc., or pulse that the mother has will be noted by the baby. But what impact that has got to be an unknown and be conjecture. And I think that there is reason to believe that there is an influence, but there is probably equally good reason to believe that there isn't. The answer just isn't in, would be an impossibility to test. I mean, to imagine the clinical study where you have one set of pregnancies that you purposefully say, these pregnancies are pretty close to the same, only you are going to, you know, every night somehow have to watch horror pictures or something else to alter your emotions, and you are going to get to watch beautiful pictures all night and have a very pleasant experience, then we'll see how the babies come out. As you can see, that's impossible to do, and so no, that knowledge is to some extent impossible. But the conjecture on it, I think, is reasonable, because the baby can acquire stimuli from outside. Yes. Right. The question is what factor determines the weight of a baby? And the true factor is that the single highest factor determining the weight of an infant is the mother's weight. Okay. Although many people conjecture that there should be a problem if you have a 4-foot mother and a 6'5 father, it usually doesn't happen that way. And we see many times, for instance, an Oriental person marrying a Swede, and she doesn't have any trouble delivering the baby because her size seems to be the largest determinant. The other question was, part of that question was related to weight gain, and how come some people gain 40 pounds and have a 6-pound baby, and other people gain 16 pounds and have a 10-pound baby? And I guess the answer to that is that the actual products of conception, on the average, counting the placenta, the amniotic fluid, and the baby, again, on the average, doesn't come out to be more than about 10 pounds. That can change a little bit, of course, varying with the size of the baby, but we're talking about average babies being from 6 to 8 pounds probably. In northern central United States, it's probably more like 7 to 9 pounds. And so that the other couple pounds are related to the amniotic fluid, etc. The things that vary between people more is how much fluid retention that they have. If a patient has a little toxemia of pregnancy, she'll retain buckets of water, and that will add weight. And the other thing would be just plain eating habits, where, as we talked about last night, most everything that you eat over and above what you and the baby are going to use is going to get stored. You don't get by with that binge on chocolate chip cookies that you get by with when you're in college. If you're pregnant, the baby says, I want those, maybe later, so you'll keep them on board. So those are the variables. Not much variable in terms of the products of conception, maybe 1 to 3 pounds, but most of the variation is in other things. You're saying, well, why should normal weight gain be 20 pounds if the baby and the placenta and the amniotic fluid is only 10? Well, there's a normal increase in breast size, there's a normal increase in blood volume, which weighs quite a bit, and there's probably somewhere around 2 or 3 pounds of storage fat that you absolutely should gain during pregnancy as sort of insurance policy, I guess you could say. But it appears to be physiologic and almost unavoidable, so that we come up with a 20-pound suggested minimum weight gain during pregnancy and about a 30-pound suggested maximum, knowing that more than that won't necessarily hurt the baby. It'll just be what you have to get rid of afterwards. The question is regarding once a cesarean, always a cesarean. Is this true? No, it isn't true. And as the numbers of cesarean births increase almost astronomically in the United States, the biggest cause of that is repeat cesarean section. And repeat has been the standard of care on the medical community in the United States for years. It probably has been overly conservative. There's a number of ifs. If you didn't have a cesarean section for reasons that are repeatable, such as the baby's too big for your given skeletal pelvis, okay? There's obviously not a whole lot of reason to think that your second baby is going to be a whole lot smaller. However, if the first one was done for breech presentation or for toxemia of pregnancy or for twins or for other things that aren't necessarily repetitive, placenta previa, for instance, and if your doctor made an incision in the uterus that was crossways instead of vertically, then it's considered to be reasonable to allow a trial of vaginal delivery with the next baby. There's a gigantic if about that, and that's that you shouldn't probably try it unless you have anesthesia available immediately and have blood banking available immediately. Because what we worry about with a vaginal delivery after cesarean section is that that scar in the uterus won't stand up to the strain of labor and delivery and will rupture. And if the scar ruptures, that can be very rapidly fatal for the baby and can be fatal for mother, or at least the most common result is the loss of the uterus. So that It's no small thing to play around with, even though the chances are very small. That's always the bad thing about talking about this subject. You know, there may only be somewhere in the neighborhood of a 1 in 100 to 100, 150 chance that that's going to happen. But if you're the one, you're the one, and you give up an awful lot. So that I think that we're going to come to, as many C-sections that are being done, that repeat C-section is not going to become a routine thing anymore. But always you've got to bear in mind why it has been a routine thing and what risks you're taking when you don't. Yes. The question was the increased incidence of cesarean section for failure to progress. And failure to progress is a garbage term which can be utilized either in a very good way in the interest of the best patient care, or can be used as an excuse. And the medical profession has all varieties of people in it, just like every other profession has in it. And some people are in a hurry, or one way or another, can use that particular set of words to justify a C-section. The other side of the coin is that, to give you a little bit of, I should sort of say, pathos for the physician that's taking care of you, that if something goes wrong with a baby that you're taking care of in labor and delivery, you are subject to the statute of limitations on suits for that baby is 22 years. Until the baby has attained the age of 22, the baby can sue you. So you can see why a certain amount of fear about that baby coming out okay is there. The other thing is that 75% of the settlements over $50,000 last year were obstetrically related. So that the malpractice crisis, if you will, is leading toward increased numbers of C-sections. And usually those that are pretty much on that basis get called failure to progress. What we would prefer to see are cesarean sections for cephalopelvic disproportion, which means that you have proved by contractions and by adequate efforts at getting that baby out vaginally that the baby is either too big or in some way not presenting itself well to the pelvis so that it doesn't come through. And so you hit a nerve with that failure to progress. Well, unless there was some, clearly negligent way that the procedure was done, there is a risk of about 1 in 500 of the death of a baby in doing an amniocentesis, and that's in an early pregnancy, 14 to 16 weeks. The risk is quite a bit smaller, close to term. Now, how the needle itself killing the baby directly is almost remarkable. I mean, I'm sure the physician didn't use multiple injections, and I guess I would ask you how you would kill a baby that was born with one needle stick. It'd be pretty hard. Probably what happened was separation of the placenta, perhaps as a result of the needle stick. And like I said, that is one of the risks of amniocentesis, although the chances are very small. 1 in 500 is about the risk that it's run, and that's part of the risk of the procedure needs to be explained, which incidentally is the etiology of why 35 is the magic age at which amniocentesis is recommended. Because at age 35, the risk of Down syndrome is 1 in 500. And so they equal themselves. There's nothing magic about 35 other than that. Your chances of having a baby with Down syndrome is twice as much at 30 than it was at 20. So there's nothing magic about 35, and there's nothing magic about 36. It's just that you pass the risk of the amniocentesis. Well, any last quick questions before we turn it over to Vespers? Okay. The question is, does the amniocentesis ever cause trauma to the fetus? On rare occasions, the baby's arm or leg or something like that could be stuck. If it's a day before delivery, usually what you see is a baby has a pinhole or a scratch in its leg when it's born, and that's usually about the end result of it. If it happens in an early amniocentesis, one done for genetic reasons, sometimes that will form a definite divot in the skin and perhaps even could damage the musculature because of how small the baby was when it happened. That is nearly avoidable by using ultrasound control for the needle stick itself, but that wasn't available just a few years ago. But now we can pretty much see where the baby's arms and legs are when we put the needle in. Well, thank you very much for your attention, and happy holding.